and tucks her hair behind her ears. It slips forward again, almost as soon as she starts talking. I believe that those emotions we noted, what seemed to be anger, perhaps a kind of frustration, are his, Isabel. I do. But it's hard to disentangle them from you in the simulation. So we have to find something else, something more. I feel myself leaning forward. 3 of Yarick's mirror neurons were activated at that cliff scene. We examined them more closely, and we did find a couple of ghost memories. She turns towards Daniel, reminding him for clarity, encoded once in the brain's normal neurons and once again in the mirror neurons. He nods. I nod. And in the 3rd mirror neuron, we found a 3rd ghost memory on its own. The one I just showed you, lower down on the visualization. This one was completely different in its intensity. Something huge. Her voice is growing more animated. She's almost grinning in excitement. If these memories were measured like an earthquake, the 1st ones would be a 4, maybe a 5 on the Richter scale, enough to cause some localized damage around the epicenter, maybe a few fatalities. She pauses for effect. But the 3rd one? That would be an 8 or a 9, a rare event, and one causing widespread, long-lasting devastation. The kind you'd hear about on the international news.
You think that memory is the murder?
I realize that it's the 1st time I've really acknowledged it aloud. The 1st time I've truly admitted my willingness to believe it.
But I am more than willing. I am desperate.
It could be, she says. And as for those 1st less intense memories, well, they're anyone's guess at this stage, but they're clearly of major importance to Yarick. All I'd say is that the fact they were activated at the cliff scene in the presence of Sarah suggests they may be related in some way to the murder.
Jess finishes and signals that she's come to the end by resting her hands onto her thighs and dropping her gaze to the floor.
I can see, more than ever, the tiredness etched into her face. I know her well enough to be sure that she has lived in this lab since coming back from Mumbai. She has lived and breathed the diagnostics of Yarick's Heaven until she knows every detail. She is my savior, and I feel a rush of affection for her. She has always had my back. I remember her warning to me in the cafe around the corner. She could see me falling, reeling. She sees it now.
And you need me again to see all of this.
I hardly hear my own voice. It's not even a question. We all know why we're here now.
We're going to have to connect your mirror neurons again. Ironically, putting all of your consciousness in with all of Yarick's is the only way that we can separate out what's your memory and what's his, so that we can have 2 separate brainwave readouts, 2 separate visualizations, says Jess. Otherwise, it'd be like the data we have from the cliff scene, controversial and open to being misread.
Last time, I begin, the words faltering as soon as they form in my mouth. Last time my mirror neurons were almost destroyed. Last time, Leela died. Spoken aloud, the fact horrifies me afresh.
I see Jess look at Daniel. This won't be like last time. I can't honestly tell you this is low risk, but we're safer here than in Mumbai.
And I can't confront Yarick. I can't go in there and speak to him.
We'll only be running those ghost memories of Yarick's into your brain. Nothing else, no heaven. What I think will happen is that because you'll be experiencing a specific memory, it'll be like watching a movie. After all, this isn't the heaven you created for him, and you're not in it.
Then can't anyone look at them? Why me?
Because you're all ready to go, Isabel, Jess says, touching the tips of her fingers to the fuzzy patches of scalp around the metal plugs in my skull.
And because I think you might need to see this for yourself.
I sigh and drop my gaze. I stare at my hands, turning them over and inspecting them. Would anyone really believe that these slim, bony fingers could kill another person? Would a jury not see that these hands were built for comforting people in their time of need, or pulling a thread delicately across an eyebrow? I could take my chances, I think. I could argue my case. I have Don as my alibi. Strong, capable Don. He would look great in court. A Ministry of Defence consultant, they'd love him. Is it even legal to do this here? I ask, looking first at Jess, then at Daniel. There was a reason we all flew to Mumbai, wasn't there? Like I said, it's not really Yarrick's heaven we're looking at. I'll tell people I found this accidentally during my research. I'm scared, but my head moves. It's nodding. It's all set up, she continues. It's all ready to go. I've got Yarrick's neurons primed in the right places. I promise we'll get you in and out as quickly as possible, straight from one memory to the next. Here we go, I say to myself, as we all get up and walk out of the office into lab number 5. Chapter 31. It's all a little ad hoc. I'm not lying on a hospital bed, or indeed any kind of bed, but on the cold, hard lab bench. I'm fully clothed, but the woolly jumper is off and I'm down to my t-shirt. There's no sheet to cover me. Despite Daniel's concerns, comfort isn't a major issue for me. I'll be out of it soon enough. I'll be somewhere else entirely. It's warm in here, though, perhaps from the equipment that surrounds me, buzzing with electricity and boxing me in. Like a body in a coffin, I think. I am so thirsty, so hungry. It's all clean, though. At least it looks like it is. I cast my eyes around once more. Perhaps, thinking about it again, it's a bit too messy in here to be truly clean. I turn my eyes back to the ceiling, trying not to think about it. Luke, the researcher from the lab, is apparently my anaesthetist, making it 4 of us in this tiny room. 5, if you count Yarrick. Jess already had the cartridge here, set up. She must have brought it with her from the electric lab without me noticing. I saw it, almost accidentally, as she opened it up and started linking it to her equipment. I tried to stop myself from thinking about the fact that my mirror neurons will be physically linked to his again. It turns my stomach into a sickening mixture of fury and fragility. As the most impartial person we've got on hand, Luke is going to keep a written and audiovisual record of the process, says Jess. Luke inclines his head and holds up his codex. I look again at the screens and equipment around me. A lot of it looks familiar. Valhalla gave you authority to use their simulation software, I ask her.
Of course they did, Jess says. I detect a note of despondency in her voice. They want me to solve all their problems, find a way of preventing ghost memories from getting into people's heavens.
Or find a way to cover it up, Daniel says.
I stare at him, open-mouthed in surprise that he could be more cynical than me. Jess raises her eyebrows and turns away. And it's in that moment that I fully realize what these ghost memories could mean. They could mean the total collapse of the industry. No more heavens. After all, who would want one? I watch Jess as Luke rubs an anesthetic tattoo on the inside of my elbow. She moves from machine to machine, her shoulders hunched, and I wonder what lengths Valhalla, Caleb, and all the other Heaven architecture firms would go to in order to save their business. I think I know the answer. Jess would walk away, but there are many more like her who wouldn't. I look up at the LEDs that fill the ceiling and watch them first seem to brighten and then dim, as Jess closes the curtains and then turns them down so that she can pull up the simulations at the back of the room. The drugs fill my veins, and they calm the last of the fight in me. The tenderness is soothed. I am resigned. I am sinking. As my eyes fall shut, I am thinking about the excitement that filled me last time as I prepared to see Yarrick in my heaven. This time, it is completely different. I am standing on a headland, my toes curled over the edge. I'm watching the waves crash on the red, jagged rocks below me, and my insides are too paralyzed to care what happens next. I'm straight into it. My cats don't purr at my legs. I don't play with my sister or dance with my mother. I don't reach out to pick ripe blackberries beneath the red of an autumn sun. My heaven is bypassed completely. It feels different, just as Jess said it would. I'm walking into a house, through a side door, it seems. As the scene around me starts to crystallize, I realize that I'm behind Yarrick. I recognize his rusty hair atop those broad shoulders. He walks tall, with purpose, not with the weakening inclination to the left that he had while I knew him. That stoop lent him valuable vulnerability. I'm just watching his memory, but I feel as though he will spot me at any moment. I stay behind a doorway and let him move on into what I think is the kitchen. I remain with my back to the wall and listen to him walk around. He is still wearing his shoes, but he is moving very quietly, deliberately so. I can barely make out what he is doing. It's then that I realize I can't hear anything at all. This ghost memory is silent. And now I see that my view of it has never fully crystallized. The edges of my vision fade into blank white space where there should be a wall or a ceiling or an item of furniture. It's like tunnel vision. This memory doesn't have the touch of my work. It's rough and worn. It's been buried for too long to be perfect. It hasn't been shaped and coaxed back into life by the architecture of heaven. Something more primal lurks here. I remember why I am here. I am going to see something that changes Yarrick forever. That is the only reason this memory exists, copied into the very depths of his consciousness. I swallow and steel myself. I let my heart thud against the walls of my chest, let its rhythm attempt to calm me. But it's uneven and speeds up. It's putting up my defenses and getting me ready to run. From the ghostly silence, noise appears. There is a thump from above my head, from upstairs, swiftly followed by laughter, high and joyful, a woman's laughter. Yarrick rushes out from the kitchen, and I am sure that he'll see me then, standing right there behind the doorframe, but he looks straight through me. The rules are different here, I remember. This ghost memory has never met me. We aren't in the Aston Martin, or in the basement room, or my apartment. We are together, but separate, and I am relieved. I hear the taunting tinkle of laughter again. It is the only sound other than my own heartbeat, yet it's as if I can hear his mind working. It's rolling into a different gear, setting itself up for something it's never known. For a moment, I wonder which of the memories I am in. I can see that he is younger here, and it is long before the glioblastoma took hold. This ghost memory must date back several years. Yarrick is standing stock still. His face is calm. His hands are hanging at his sides, fingers flexed, feet shoulder-width apart on the glossy wooden floor. He is reflected in it. I look down and notice that I am not.
There is a sudden flash of movement, and Yarrick rushes past me. I don't want to follow him, but I know that I must.
I take comfort in the fact that I am invisible. As Yarrick tiptoes up the stairs, I remain a few steps behind, staring at the spot where his shirt is tucked into his belted suit trousers. I let myself admire his body. It belongs to a man a few years younger than the one I knew, stronger, perhaps happier. And momentarily I let myself imagine meeting this Yarrick and wonder how different things would have been. He stops halfway up, dropping his gaze as if concentrating on the sounds coming from the room to the right of us. I can't see what's beyond. I can only see the stairs and the door and the landing outside it. Silent, white noise supports it all. As Yarrick creeps up the final few steps, the emotions start to take hold of me. Like that scene on the cliff, there is a growing sense of tension in the air. This time I don't feel it as if it were mine, but I sense it, as if it's radiating from the back of his neck. I start to feel fear for whoever is inside the room, but that emotion is all mine. We move along the landing, and a musky, flowery fragrance invades my senses. It's seeping out from around the doorframe like smoke. I recognize it. I used to burn an oil that smelt like this to sweeten the air of my apartment when I lived alone. It's ylang ylang. Don couldn't bear it. I had to throw it away when we first moved in together. But it's an aphrodisiac, I told him teasingly, as I tried to persuade him to let the oil burner stay.
Men like me don't need an aphrodisiac, he said,
sweeping me up in his arms and carrying me to the bedroom. I smile. It's a happy memory. Scent forms the strongest memories. I realize now that I also kept the oil in my office at Oakley. A few drops in a dish as a soothing background scent. Yarrick commented upon it on our first meeting. Did it remind him of this memory I'm in now? Did it incite anger in him from the moment I met him? Yarrick's hand is on the doorknob, gripping tightly so that his knuckles are pale, fading into the paintwork around them. I edge forward until I'm standing almost directly behind him. I know I have to give Jess and Daniel the best chance to capture what happens next. I suppose I expect Yarrick to fling the door open widely, dramatically, but he does the opposite. He turns the knob so slowly that I can barely notice the movement despite the fact I'm staring at it. He must know more about what he is going to see than I do, although I have an idea that is rapidly sharpening in my mind. Perhaps our thoughts and emotions are moving together again, two parallel streams meeting briefly before separating once more. I fight to pull us apart, closing off my mind as the door cracks open. He cannot implicate me in death, having already succeeded in life. I cannot see beyond him. His body fills the tiny opening of the door. Open it! I want to scream. Open it! I want to push him. I need to see what's inside. Jess needs to see what's inside, otherwise they can't save me. Otherwise, I am lost. The climax is calm. Yarrick's hand loosens from the knob and drops to his side as he straightens up. I stay standing behind him to his left, but I can see it all as the door slowly swings open. The bed stands directly opposite us against the wall. It is surrounded by uncertainty that is coloured a pale pinky red rather than the pure white around the stairs and the landing. It is the colour of love and of fury. Sex toys are scattered across the crumpled bed. I look at each one in turn, as he must have done. I involuntarily feel a pang of pity for him, then. The injustice of it is palpable. The couple are standing in an embrace. Their curves wrap and diffuse into each other. It's the flame-haired woman who notices him first. Even her hair is redder than his, artificially bright and looping in tousled clumps around her shoulders. Her mouth falls open, and I watch as her hand tightens on the back of the other figure, a warning. Far too late. The soft brown hair trembles at her waist, and Sarah slowly looks around, fearful eyes flicking over her shoulder in our direction. I feel my mouth fall open for a different reason to Yarrick. She is truly beautiful. The top of her nose catches the sunlight streaming in from a window I can't see. Her lips are pressed together. They are still full and tinged red from passion. She has the body of a woman, not a girl, but she is young, perhaps in her early 20s. In a less incriminating situation, you might call her statuesque, but she shrinks under his gaze. Part of me feels as though I should look away, but I stare at the dimples at the base of her back and feel envy rise at the sinuous curve of her hip, and, as she turns further, the heavy fullness of her breasts. She is so different from me. Did Yarrick even find me attractive? Was I nothing more than convenient? I feel embarrassed, but I hold my head up into the rich silence that hangs in the air between the four of us. Sarah's hands drop from the woman's shoulders to her sides, and the red-haired woman starts to pick up her clothes from the floor. I watch, transfixed, as she pulls on a sweater without bothering to put on her bra first, stuffing her undergarments into a bag instead. "I'm sorry," Sarah says, her voice hushed in shock, her eyes upon her husband. "I'm so sorry, Yarrick." Her face is fragmented by a tangle of emotions, and her heavily made-up eyes slant downwards, wide and glassy like a doll's. "Come on, Sarah, you don't have to put up with his shit," the woman spits her words out. "You can't play his games anymore." Her free hand is outstretched, but Sarah's feet are anchored to the floor, and she drops her eyes apologetically. The woman's voice softens. "This isn't what love looks like." She stares at Sarah a little longer before shaking her head in defeat. She turns and sharpens her gaze into Yarrick's face, and her eyes blaze with defiance as she pushes past us, still half-dressed and dishevelled. I move, because I don't want to find out if she will walk straight through me. I see Yarrick clutch at her arm fiercely, forcing her close to his chest. She smells as if she has spent hours in this room, with the ylang-ylang and with Sarah. "I will kill you if you come back here," he whispers ferociously in her ear. His fingers make craters into her forearm, and she winces under their pressure before he lets her go. I hear her jog down the stairs and out of the house, slamming the front door violently behind her. It is the first loud noise that this memory holds, and it makes me shudder. Yarrick falls upon Sarah then. I stand in the doorway, my hand pressed against my mouth as I watch him rampage. He approaches her in what is like a sprint, but only covers a few meters of space. She cowers, her hands at the sides of her head. I watch helplessly as he raises the flat of his hand and brings it flying across her face. My heart recoils with the sound it makes, sharp and damp upon her cheek. It knocks her onto the bed, and a flicker of nausea hits my belly. I realize I have never seen anyone this angry before. I have never myself felt this degree of fury. The anger I feel towards Yarrick is only just beginning to drag at my ankles, an emotion that's slowly growing into life. It's not the flaring, dagger-like madness that grips him here. I take a step backwards. I can hardly bear to watch, but I know that I have no choice.
How could you do that to me, after everything I've done for you?
Words pummel her alongside his fists. I clench my teeth and remind myself that this is all in the past. The memory is fractured by adrenaline. I don't always see it from my perspective. My consciousness can't always arrange itself properly according to Yarrick's thoughts. It can't always make the necessary adjustments. I see the splatter of tiny droplets of blood against white linen. I get a glimpse of Yarrick's fist, buried in her hazel hair, as if it's right in front of me rather than across the room. I never know what is coming next, and the shock fills me, detaches me from what I'm seeing. It has to, otherwise I'd run screaming.
Why do you always push me to this, Sarah?
I watch him undo his belt with unease. I wait for him to whip it across her bare body, over that soft, pale skin. But he drops it to the floor with his trousers. I could vomit. The bile rises in the back of my throat, and both my hands cover my mouth to push it back. This is the moment that Yarrick snaps, and they both break. He forces himself into her with a grim determination. I have let this man run his hands tenderly through my hair, and I would never have known he was capable of this. I stop hearing anything but the creak of the bed. I wonder if Sarah really was wordless, really was completely silent during this awful encounter. Was she so unsurprised by it? Had this treatment become a way of life for her? Perhaps Yarrick didn't hear her through the blood that pumped and screamed at his temples. It goes on for so long that eventually I know I have seen enough. The barbarity of a few seconds would have been enough. I close my eyes. I wish I had closed them sooner and count my heartbeats until they soften and slow. Fragments appear. Discordant slices of a story I recognize, combined with ones I don't. I open the door to Yarrick. It is afternoon, and the sun streaks in through the living room window onto his hair. He looks surprised to see me in my own apartment. As I grasp at them, the memories slip and slide through my fingertips. I don't remember opening my eyes, but I'm standing on a sun-bathed street, looking at the display outside a florist's shop. The image is framed like a picture against a blank wall. I jump when I realize Yarrick is standing right beside me, almost touching me because his body leans that way, stooping to the left. It is the Yarrick I know. From his other side, I see a tiny hand reach out and point at the flowers. It is Helena, his daughter. She tugs him forward, and I feel it too.
These, Daddy! These ones!
She's pointing at the bucket full of anemones, their black centres focused upon us like angry eyes. Yarrick folds his arms and smiles.
Do you think Mummy will be pleased?
Helena turns back towards him, her plait swinging over her shoulder, and nods insistently. As she turns her face upwards into the sun, I notice the scabs that dot her forehead. Chickenpox, I think. It is the same day I saw them at the burial ground. It is the same day that Yarick called to cancel our appointment minutes before it was due to begin.
Do you think they will make Mummy let me into her heaven?
Helena frowns, confused.
Yes,
she says uncertainly. I look at Yarick's face and try to read it. He's grinning at his daughter, but his words unsettle me. I'm confused. Had Sarah refused to grant Yarick access to her heaven? A lady emerges from the shop and offers to wrap the anemones. He pulls out the stems I know he will, 6 white, 6 purple. I think of Sarah that day in the shop, choosing the random bunches and then swapping them for my peonies. She was slipping out from under his control, striking out alone. Look at us, hey? Buying our own flowers. He pays, and they move on down the street. I walk slightly behind them, sheltered from the crowds in the wake of Yarick's awkward gait. I reach out tentatively as a woman walks past. My hand doesn't catch on her jacket. It passes right through as if she is a mirage. Or as if I am.
We don't have much time, but shall we go and play Spy on Mummy?
Yarick says to Helena. I can hear him as clearly as if he's whispering directly into my ear. Helena nods with excitement.
Tell me what you know, Agent Helena,
he says. He pulls her closer to him and crouches down in the middle of the street, dropping the bunch of flowers onto the pavement.
She said she was taking Eden to playgroup, Helena says, hopefully.
Her eyebrows lift towards her father, and I see her eagerness to please him. I remember being like that.
Well, that'll be over now, but maybe she's somewhere nearby. Shall we track her chip?
Mummy doesn't like that.
Doesn't she? Well, if it makes her sad, we don't have to tell her, do we?
Helena shakes her head, and time must skip forward because all of a sudden we're in the chill of a shaded avenue.
Here,
murmurs Yarick, looking across the road. There's a small coffee shop a few doors further up that he settles his gaze upon. From here, I can see a few people are sitting at the bistro tables outside, but not Sarah and their daughter.
Stay close,
Yarick says, and I nod before I remember he's talking to Helena.
We're going in.
There's something creepy about the way he's making this a game, and I feel complicit as we move so that we're directly opposite the coffee shop. Yarick pulls Helena into his legs as they slip behind an autocab stop. I look, as they do, through the scratched screen of plastic, over the traffic, to the wide window of the cafe. There, at the first table on the left, sits Sarah. Their youngest daughter is sitting happily on her lap, and beside her is a man, whose head is tipped back in laughter when we first see him. As the man brings his head back level, he rakes one hand through his blonde hair and places his other hand over Sarah's. It could just be a friendly touch, but the man's hand stays there, atop Sarah's, and although we are across the street, I'm sure that I can see their fingers entwine. Perhaps I'm wrong. Perhaps Yarick is wrong. I hear him take a sharp intake of breath, and it sounds as if it comes from inside my own throat.
Ow, Daddy!
Helena squeals. I think he is holding her hand too tightly. I can feel him trembling beside me.
Do you know him, Helena?
She shakes her head vehemently. I study his face. A clenched jaw betrays his fury. His squinted eyes are sharp with focus, observing every detail of the scene. He is taking the time to absorb this man's face, his clothes, his demeanor. I guess that he hasn't seen him before. He must also see Sarah's tight, guarded smile. It is, I think, a smile that will change when Yarrick is gone, and she is finally free. I remember what Daniel said about the possibility that she had already decided to end their marriage. Maybe she has already walked away. Maybe that's why Yarrick was talking about Sarah not letting him into her heaven.
"Can we go and play with Mummy and Eden and their friend?"
Helena's voice is bright, eager. Their friend. I think this is what does it. The man in that coffee shop will not just be part of Sarah's life after Yarrick is gone. It will be part of their daughters' lives, too. When Yarrick dies, soon, so soon, that man will also meet Helena. That man will take Yarrick's place in their family. He will replace him. To Yarrick, this man poses an even greater threat than the woman he found in his bedroom.
"I've told you before," Yarrick says, his voice brittle. "Mummy doesn't want to play with Daddy anymore."
My mouth falls open, and I look back across the road at Sarah's face. She is laughing now, her defenses down. Daniel was right. She had already left him. I watch with sadness as Yarrick shakily lifts his fingertip to his ear canal. He is about to call the clinic. In a few seconds he will be talking to me, telling me that he can't come to our session because he's had an unexpected afternoon. I am about to tell him that I was looking forward to seeing him with an unmistakable desire in my voice. I am about to tell him he will be untouchable in his heaven. I promise him. Unknowingly, I convince him that everything he wants to do is okay. I give him strength. I plant a seed in his mind. Chapter 32. My guilt becomes silence. And it's a silence the like of which I've never known. It is a true void. An absence of everything. I don't even hear my own body anymore, shifting beneath clothing or rising and falling as the tissues that form me adjust and expand and contract. I am only thought. Only my mind is left, and even that lies in this state of enforced meditation. For those few moments, as Jess takes my connections apart and links me up to the neuron containing Yarrick's third and final ghost memory, the nothingness takes hold. There is no beauty. There is no darkness. It isn't either terrifying or uplifting, but there is something in it. There is peace. Before I open my eyes into the new memory, I somehow know I'll see either blinding whiteness or pure jet black. As it turns out, it is strangely both. Like an optical illusion, the void that surrounds me, that is me, fades from one to the other as I absorb it. Momentarily, I am Yarrick, clasping my hand around a canister of pills. I stare at my hand, scared the simulation will show the wrong thing. But I'm looking at a man's hand, too big to be mine. I look like I'm wearing a glove that's dotted with freckles and trimmed with thick hairs which creep up from my wrist, sprouting across the pale skin. I shake that memory away. The black-white void flickers back, and then I'm plunged into something new, as clear and real as the scene I was in before. I'm standing behind him, on an escalator that rises out of the belly of a tube station. I can't see much, save for the metal grooves of the moving steps and Yarrick's back a few steps ahead. I know it's a London Underground station by the smell, the tight, swirling scent of trapped bodies and human heat, the damp aroma of rain clinging to old tiles, and the staleness of air that stays too long beneath the streets. Yarrick walks out through the scanners and one flashes against his face. Not for me. I slip through unnoticed. I glance up at the red, white and blue sign. Maidavale Station, it reads proudly, against the antique red tiles of the building. As he strides lopsidedly forward onto the street, I'm surprised by the darkness of the sky and the flicker of the streetlights. It is late. If this is the day he came to my apartment and I gave him the pills, then he left long ago. As he flaps his overcoat, about to button it up, my nostrils catch the waft of alcohol that flares around him. He pulls a hood up over his head. That won't disguise the distinctive lumber of his disease-induced gait. Even without seeing his face, I know that it is gaunt now. His shoulders have lost the strength they had before, when he threw the furious energy of his weight upon Sarah in their bedroom. We cross the road. He doesn't walk fast. I almost fall over my feet in an effort to stay behind him. His stoop is worse than I remember. At the top of the avenue, he stops to rest against a tree. He leans into it, a sorry sight. I watch his shoulders rise and fall. He presses one hand to the left side of his head, wincing, and we both look up at the sliver of moon that decorates the muddy sky. If this is the night, the Friday night that Sarah dies, then Yarrick himself is dead within hours. I wonder how he had the strength to make love to me that afternoon. Not passion, perhaps, but desperation. A need to bring his plan to fruition. I would never have known. Pedestrians pass me, pass right through me. This must be what it's like to be a ghost. Part of me, a larger part than I might admit, wants to go and hold him. I know that I can't. It's not possible. He wouldn't even see me or hear me. This is like watching a film. I tell myself no and hold my feet firm on the pavement. Eventually, he heaves himself forward up the street. As I dutifully follow, the weight of the night starts to press down upon me. It's as if I can feel the tension coil and spring from the muscles that remain on Yarrick's back. His hands are thrust deep into his coat, his head is bowed, and if you didn't know he was dying from a vicious brain tumour, you would think that he was drunk. Perhaps he is. He veers to the left and then corrects himself again and again as we walk down the street. I start to recognize the neighborhood. I remember waiting here, hoping to catch a glimpse of Sarah. Little did I know that she had already called an end to their marriage. Such a shame that, the florist had said to me. I used to see him in here a lot. Yarrick pauses again, resting his hand upon the wrought-iron gatepost of his house. My stomach tightens and twists. He looks up and down the street, straight through me, and I feel a wash of sadness, or possibly regret, seeping from his eyes. We seek out the moon once more, caught in the bare branches of the lime trees above our heads before going inside. I slip in the door behind him, and watch as he hangs up his keys on a little hook, draping his coat over them and taking out the canister from the pocket. He pushes it deep into the pocket of his trousers. Victorian tiles shine at my feet. A framed picture hangs to my left. Although it is blurry to me, long forgotten, I can tell from the flash of white, charcoal grey and pink, that it's a wedding photograph. The wide stairs flare open as they meet the hallway. A pair of small, purple shoes sits neatly on the bottom step. A child's shoes. I tune in my hearing, as Yarrick does, listening out for the sounds of the house and the people within it. There is nothing for a few seconds, and then there is the sound of a metal instrument clattering against enamel. There is a palpable sensation, then, that tingles against me like static. It is the sinking realization that Sarah is here, that it is going to happen. I'm not sure if it's Yarrick's feelings or my own. Perhaps it is both. I feel my heartbeat start to pick up as we advance down the corridor.
Yarrick? Is that you?
A woman calls out from behind the glazed double doors. Yarrick pushes them open, and we're greeted by the smell of lemongrass and coconut. I hate Thai food. I can't bear the chunks of fiery ginger and the floral lining it leaves in my mouth. Sarah looks up at him, fleetingly aghast. The gleaming blade in her hand hovers over a half-chopped aubergine. This is the Sarah I recognize. She looks much the same as before, but she is slightly plumper, perhaps, and her hair is shorter. It's cut into a sharp bob around her jawline. After a moment, Yarrick moves forward and lays a hand on her shoulder. Sarah puts the knife down and rounds inwards slightly, curling her spine, as if she is protecting her heart from his touch.
"What are you doing here?"
she demands, her shoulders tense.
"I thought you were coming over in the morning to spend time with the girls."
"Just thought I'd stop by."
Yarrick moves awkwardly past the island of marble and sinks into an armchair by the woodburner, its insides battered with flames. Sarah's eyes follow his movement, and she presses her lips back between her teeth. I stay where I am, by the kitchen door, where I can see them both, although the outlines and edges of the room are vague. The kitchen knife begins to fall repeatedly against the chopping board again, and I can't help but stare at the blade. I think about the splatter of blood from her face against the bedsheets. I think about how this is all supposed to unfold.
"You had your appointment with your architect today?"
Yarrick mumbles. So, Sarah was planning to create her own heaven ahead of time, like writing a will. As with some of my old clients, she didn't want to wait until she was dying.
"Yes, I told you I was going, this morning, like I said."
The strain shows in her face as she tips the vegetables into the pan. Steam sizzles up into the wrinkles that underline her eyes, softening their years of worry.
"And you haven't changed your mind?"
Seeing them here, in their luxurious, warm home, it's almost impossible to believe that they aren't a happy couple. But then I catch a glimpse of his face as it turns from the fire. It's directed at Sarah's back, and it burns with hatred. It makes me shudder, and I wonder if she can feel it too.
"Yarrick?"
Sarah puts down the knife and turns to face him, folding her arms, standing tall. Even as an outside observer, I'm not sure he wipes the expression from his face fast enough. I notice that she flicks her eyes towards the kitchen doors, as if she's checking that her exit route is clear.
"We've been through all this. We don't make each other happy. I don't think we ever did."
"You don't think you owe it to me? After everything we've been through together, to be in my heaven, for me to be in yours. You know I still love you, Sarah.
And it crystallizes. It was a smooth lie when he told me that he didn't want her in his heaven. A lie that obscured his loss of control. A lie that concealed a motive.
Love? Really? After what you've done to me?
A voice wobbles with what I interpret to be fear, or anger, or both. My stomach turns as I wonder how much violence has been a part of her life. She must have kept it to herself for so many years. It breaks me to realize that not only did he not love me, but he also had no concept of what love is. Only obsession.
Look, if you want to stay here tonight, I'll just go, Sarah says. Mum will drop the girls back first thing. Don't worry, not late. I told her not to be late again. And I'll come back tomorrow evening as planned.
The children aren't here. I wish she hadn't said that. I wish they were playing together upstairs. It might have changed everything.
You don't have to leave,
he says, watching her closely as she picks up her codex and lifts her handbag onto the work surface.
Have the food if you want it, just need stir-frying. I'll grab a takeaway or something.
She speaks quickly, stumbling over her words.
I'm sorry to have surprised you like this,
Yarrick says.
It's just been a hard day. Every day is harder now.
He speaks softly, but there is none of the charm that I used to adore. There are no light-hearted jokes, no winks, no showmanship. He's used up all his energy on me. And what is left, he is conserving. He is withdrawing inside himself, centering his strength for one final task. There is perhaps one last thing to check.
How are the girls?
They've been fine. We don't need to tell them anything about us yet, and I'll have a chat with Mum next week.
I look back at Yarrick. But there is nothing to disturb me in what I see. His isn't the face of a man preparing to commit such a heinous crime. He looks ill, yes, but he's relaxed in the radiance of the fire. His hands are loosely folded in his lap and his head rests against the back of the chair. And he is smiling. Smiling over his love for his children.
Once more, he has tricked me. Because in the next beat of my heart, he has risen from the chair and is walking back across the kitchen.
Sarah fumbles in her bag as I watch Yarrick move around the kitchen, closing all the blinds fully. I watch him extract the lid of the canister from his pocket and lay it down on the work surface. He takes a wooden spoon from one of the drawers and pushes it into his back pocket, moving to stand right behind Sarah. There are no recriminations, no reasons given. Yarrick is what a barrister would call cold, calculating. It looks like the actions of a romantic husband as he takes the bag from her hand and lays it on the floor. With his other hand, he turns off the heat.
You left the hob on. Silly,
he says. I hardly recognize his voice. He stands facing her.
Where will you go this evening? Are you going to see him?
Who? I don't know what you mean.
She is a terrible liar.
You've met someone else already, haven't you?
Yarrick, please.
Sarah's hands curl into loose fists over her stomach. He doesn't speak. His mouth is set
as he focuses on what is next. He turns her around by her shoulders and presses her back against the oven. I am so close to them, a few feet away. I stumble backwards, steeling myself. He is wearing gloves now, and I see Sarah notice that at the same time I do. That's odd, I see her think. And then she must see the look on his face, because a veil of unbridled horror falls over her. It's too late for her to move because his hands are wrapped around her delicate neck, pressing. Why? I hear him say. After what you've done? Why is it only me that won't see our children grow up? How can you leave me now? Sarah vibrates. Her whole body is writhing and bucking against him. She scratches at the air in front of his eyes, but his arms are locked out straight and she cannot reach him. I watch his left arm shake, his knee buckle. He slips to the floor and drags her with him. She kicks out at his shins and thrusts her elbows towards his chest and face, and for a moment, I rejoice in thinking he's too weak to carry on. As they lie side by side, bucking and twisting, it looks as though they could be making love. But I've momentarily forgotten that I know how this story ends. Garrick eventually hauls himself up, and Sarah's body almost completely disappears beneath his.
How's that fair, Sarah?
Her choking gurgles crowd my ears. Her skin pales by the second, apart from the wrinkled pink half-moons beneath her eyes, which seem to crackle with blood. She claws at his arms, but she can't reach his skin through the thick sweater he's wearing. What upsets me the most is the way that they stare at each other. She begs in disbelief, and Yarrick just stares back at her, through her, writing her oblivion letter by letter. I bring my hands to my own throat, feeling at its delicacy, trying to imagine how much strength it would really take to crush it. He only loosens his grip when she stops making a noise, and then, with one hand, he swiftly extracts the canister from his pocket. Releasing her neck for a split second, he tips the contents into the back of her mouth. It happens at precisely the same moment she gasps for air. I imagine the sugar-coated pills fighting each other to sink down to her stomach as she tries to cough them up. I look down at the floor. Even though I know Jess and Daniel will be annoyed with me, I can't bear to see any more. But the noises are worse on their own. By the end, Yarrick's breaths shoot in and out of his nostrils in effort. Sarah moans from her stomach, chokes and splutters. I can almost hear the desperate thump of her blood. The whole room trembles. I must steady my own breathing to stay standing, gripping onto the doorframe. Eventually, it falls quiet. The vegetables are already cooling in the pan. The smell of burnt garlic and terror wafts around me. I brace myself before I look up. Yarrick lays Sarah flat on the floor and pulls her mouth open with his gloved fingers. I sear with anger as I watch him pull something out from his other trouser pocket. I walk forward. The tangle of dark, wavy hair, my hair, sits like a storm cloud in his palm. He presses it onto the end of the spoon handle, pushing it to the back of Sarah's throat and jamming the spoon up and down like a plunger before letting it clatter upon the floor. There is no satisfaction on his face, But there is no sadness either. Only what I presume is a psychopathic emptiness.